There we are. Great. So the topic we're thinking about today is this question of whether science has made God redundant. This idea that science and faith are in conflict is a very, I think it's a very pervasive idea, and it runs pretty deep. I was watching a Amazon box set the other day. I came across this chap. He's the young Sheldon. You may be familiar with a very successful Big Bang Theory, or the comedy sitcom. Young Sheldon is one of the characters, Sheldon, before he's grown up. And in this episode I was watching, I saw him enter a debate with a preacher in America. This preacher, he was preaching from the front, and he was clearly overexcited and undereducated. And Sheldon put his hand up and took him to task. And during the course of the debate, he said this: "Science is facts, religion is faith. I prefer facts. Science is fact, religion is faith. I prefer facts." Now, as a scientist, I can very much sympathise with that perspective. I cringe a little bit at the simple depiction of science as facts, but on the other hand, I know what he's talking about. Science tries to understand the world through observation and experiment and logical deduction. We teach our students to try and explore phenomena by kind of uncovering measurable mechanisms behind what's going on. And surely that way of understanding things is fundamentally opposed to the way of religion and faith. The idea, it's a very, very deeply held and pervasive idea. Here's another chap. This is James Watson, a very famous and eminent scientist, co-discoverer with Francis Crick of the double helical structure of DNA. He says this about religious scientists like me. He says, "Occasionally I meet them and I'm a bit embarrassed because I cannot believe anyone who accepts truth by revelation." So obviously that hurts me a bit. So what I want to do today is to somehow justify my own existence as a religious scientist. But it also touches a nerve, because it makes me wonder, am I living this double life where I have one standard for belief in my professional life as a scientist, and a completely different standard for my beliefs in my personal life as a Christian? And maybe you're someone who's interested in the Christian claims about God, and yet are worried about sacrificing your intellectual integrity, about having to give up on the idea of truth and fact. And I want to reassure you that I very much sympathize with this perspective. I think it's something that's very right to be concerned about, because if it really is the case of choosing between blind faith and sure facts, I know which way I'd want to go. But the idea I want to explore is that it's not quite as straightforward a choice as that. To kick us off, I just want to consider this chap. This is Francis Collins. James Watson, who we just saw, launched in the 1990s the Human Genome Project, this great international scientific research project to map the human genetic code. Francis Collins here is the scientist that saw through this project to its completion. He wrote a book called The Language of God, telling the story of the Human Genome Project, telling his own story as a scientist, but also his discovery for himself of the Christian faith. And towards the end of the book, he said, "I started this journey of intellectual exploration to confirm my atheism. That now lay in ruins as I was forced to admit the plausibility of the God hypothesis." So if nothing else, that should give us pause that it might not be quite as simple as people like the young Sheldon or James Watson would have us believe. It's maybe quite possible to be kind of immersed in the sciences and yet find oneself to be intellectually compelled towards accepting the Christian claims about God for yourself. So that's the idea I'd like us to explore. Now, if like me, you've enjoyed a staple diet of popular science writing, one of the big stories that's often told in that writing is of the long history of conflict between science and religion. The idea that the great scientific revolutionaries of the past had to fight tooth and nail against the strongholds of superstition and religion to bring about a great age of scientific enlightenment and reason. It's a very powerful story. But when you start actually digging into the history of science, you realize, again, that things really aren't quite as simple. You start noticing that many of the great scientific revolutionaries of the past, people like Copernicus and Kepler, even Galileo, Boyle, Faraday, Clerk Maxwell, some of the great scientists, didn't just happen to believe in God, didn't just happen to be Christians, they were fundamentally motivated in what they were doing by their religious belief. A walk through the Hall of Fame of Nobel laureates, surprising, over the past century, around 60% of Nobel laureates profess to be Christian. Plenty of cause in that Hall of Fame for James Watson to be embarrassed. And so the first point I want to make is a very simple one, that this idea of a long conflict between science and religion isn't something that's born out in history. The historian of science, Peter Harrison, he makes this point. He says, those who argue for the incompatibility of science and religion will draw little comfort from history. The myth of a perennial conflict between science and religion is one to which no historian of science would subscribe. Very emphatic. But that's history. That's history. The whole thing about science is it's marked by progress. Old ideas are discarded for new theories that offer us a deeper and fuller grasp of reality. Perhaps religion is no, science has made religion redundant. Perhaps God is no longer a legitimate thing to believe in because science has helped us advance beyond that idea. This is certainly the view of Peter Atkins, who was professor of chemistry at Oxford, and he says this. He says, science, the system of belief founded securely on publicly shared reproducible knowledge, emerged from religion. As science discarded its chrysalis to become its present butterfly, it took over the heath. So for Atkins, religion had a role to play in our intellectual history as human beings, but that role has now been thoroughly superseded by science. And like a butterfly emerging from a restrictive chrysalis. So science has allowed humanity to spread its intellectual wings. He goes on to say, there is no reason to suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of existence. Only the religious hope there is a dark corner of the physical universe or of the universe of experience that science can never hope to illuminate. So there's two very important claims and ideas here that I want to investigate. First of all, there's the idea of the sufficiency of science. Science gives us this complete, fully orbed, comprehensive understanding of ourselves, the universe, and everything that ultimately leaves no room for God or religious type explanations. That's the first thing, the sufficiency of science. But also there is the idea that science is somehow exclusive. Science gives us this publicly shared, reproducible knowledge. Science is exclusive in its ability to give us a reliable understanding of the world, a reliable access to what is true and real. And they're the two big ideas that I'd like us to think about. First point, though, I want to make is that there is no denying the power of science. There's no denying the power of science. I want to tell you a bit about one of the big breakthroughs in my research area by this chap here, Shinya Yamanaka, who discovered what came to be called induced pluripotent stem cells. He won a Nobel Prize for this discovery. What are induced pluripotent stem cells? So the word pluripotent there refers to the ability of stem cells to specialize into all of the different types of cells that make up our body. So when we were right at the beginning of our development in an embryo, we were basically a ball of stem cells. Those cells couldn't do much, but they were pluripotent. They had the potential to develop into all the cells that now make up our adult bodies. As we grow, as our cells specialize, that potential's lost as cells commit to being skin cells or brain cells or bone cells, which means that their potential for regeneration, for repairing our body, is limited. But Shin Yamanaka made a very surprising discovery that it's possible to reprogram, to induce old adult cells, so cells, for example, taken from your skin, and reprogram them back into stem cells again. It's very remarkable. It means our tired old adult skin cells can kind of recover the potential they had right at the beginning of your development. Which means one day scientists could take some of those cells, turn them back into stem cells, and then specialize them to become new neurons to treat your Parkinson's, or pancreatic cells to treat diabetes, or a whole host of other cells that you need to treat various other illnesses and diseases. It's a very, very remarkable discovery. But how did he demonstrate what he'd done? Well, one of the important experiments he did was he took some of these cells, these were mouse cells from the skin, he induced them to become stem cells, and then he injected them into another mouse embryo. Now, if those were just old skin cells, they wouldn't do anything. The embryo would probably die and nothing would happen. But if they were stem cells, he reasoned, they would go on to help contribute to that developing embryo. And that's what he saw, and this is what he produced. He produced a chimeric mouse, a mouse made up of two distinct genetic identities. So half of that mouse was made up from the original mouse. Half the cells in that mouse was from the original mouse. The other half was formed from cells that were just months earlier growing in a petri dish in his lab. It's a very, very powerful demonstration of an astonishing discovery. And it's exactly this that gives science such credibility in our culture. Richard Dawkins talks about this credibility when he says, science boosts its claim to truth by its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And it's this power that science has, this ability to give us reliable knowledge of the world, that has caused many to say, well, you know what, science is the only real way we have of obtaining an understanding of ourselves, the universe, and everything. And so what we need to do is limit ourselves to only using scientific methods to understand ourselves. Now, this is a very developed project. This is one of the great advocates for this project, Daniel Dennett, and he wrote this in his book, he rather humbly called Consciousness Explained. And he says this, he says, there is only one sort of stuff, namely matter, the physical stuff of physics, chemistry, and physiology. We can, in principle, we're not there yet, scientists are working on it, account for every mental phenomena using the same physical principles, laws, and raw materials. It's the idea that all we need is physics, chemistry, and biology to understand ourselves, because after all, physics, chemistry, and biology are really the only reliable ways we have of exploring reality. Now, that sounds sensible, but it can lead to some very kind of counterintuitive conclusions. So let me give you one example. There are many I could choose from, but here's a good one. This is Richard Dawkins, someone else very committed to this way of trying to understand the world. And he was asked by an interviewer, this was actually a Christian interviewer, about the topic of love. He is asked, when you think about your wife, what does love mean? Dawkins says, well, we've been into that before. It's an emotion which is a manifestation of brain stuff. Jesus said, love is the purpose of life. Does that sound nonsense to you? Dawkins says, it sounds like something grafted on, a superfluous excrescence on life, which I feel I understand better. But it doesn't surprise me that brains, being what they are, have a capacity to invent spurious purposes of the universe. So according to Dawkins, love is nothing more than an emotion, a manifestation of brain stuff. And any idea that we have that love is of deeper or more central significance to what it means to live a meaningful human life, any idea we have that it's love that gives our life meaning and value, that those we love has a kind of that our relationships with those we love are what make our lives meaningful, that's actually something we're grafting on. It's something we're imposing on reality that's not really true. Because after all love is emotion. It's a manifestation of brain stuff. Now that's a very stark perspective on life and love. And I think intuitively it seems rather inadequate. Surely love is of more significance to what it means to be human than this. Of course, love is an emotion. It does arise out of the stuff of our brains, but surely we'd want to say something more about it than that. But because of Dawkins' prior commitment to only explaining stuff by science, by biology, chemistry and physics, he's limited to this type of explanation of love. Now this is quite a soft argument. We're basically saying this doesn't really feel right. It feels like we need to say more about love than what Dawkins says here. But there's also a much more significant, kind of harder philosophical problem with what Dawkins says here. And that comes out in the last thing he says. It doesn't surprise me that brains, being what they are, have the capacity to invent spurious purposes of the universe. He's talking about our brains, what they are and what they are for. This is another philosopher of science, Patricia Churchland, who shares the same worldview with Dawkins and Dennett. And here she again talks about our brains and what they're for. Boiled down to essentials, the principal chore of nervous systems is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. A fancier style of representing, she means the ability to think and try and make sense of the world, is advantageous so long as it is geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chance of survival. Truth, whatever that is, definitely takes the hindmost. So did you see what she's saying? She's saying the reason we think, the reason we try to make sense of the world is not ultimately to discover what's true or real, because that's not what the world's about, that's not what our brains are for. The purpose of our brains is to help us survive, and that is all. So that leads to some very significant problems. Of course, we want to say that sometimes that's true. Sometimes our needing to survive means that our brains tell us what is true. I need to know whether this lion wants to eat me or not. That true belief helps me survive, but not necessarily so. So a good example here would be religion. For Patricia Churchland, the reason religion is so ubiquitous among human cultures is certainly not because of its truth benefit. It's only in our heads because of its survival benefit. It helps social cohesion and that kind of thing. Because ultimately our brains aren't for discovering what's true. They're just there in our heads to help our body parts get where they need to be in order to survive. But that's a problem. Because if I can't trust my brain to try and make sense of the world, if that's not what my brain's for, then I can't trust my brain even when my brain tells me that I can't trust my brain. It means it's an idea that philosophers would call self-refuting, an idea that undermines itself. Someone else who recognizes this is not a believer, but he sees the implications. He says this biologistic image, this attempt to explain ourselves only in terms of biology, this biologistic image of humans effectively denies the centrality, even the possibility of precisely those unique capacities that have made humans able to theorize about evolution or to develop neuroscience. This is the point. If Darwin's On the Origin of Species really were the last word on humanity, the only thing to say, it could not have been written. So you see, this attempt to squeeze ourselves into only what we can find out by doing biology, chemistry and physics. This attempt to kind of censor out anything in our human story that's not validated by a scientific experiment ends up meaning that our human story no longer makes sense. It becomes incoherent. So in order to understand ourselves, in order to make sense of love, make sense of our ability to think, make sense of science itself, we need to go beyond science in order to understand ourselves. I'm going to skip a few slides here. But that's a problem, isn't it? Because we've already seen that, because that's the whole point. How do we go beyond science? If science is really the only reliable way we have of understanding ourselves in the world, then how can we legitimately go beyond? Maybe science isn't sufficient, but maybe it's all we've got. This is certainly the view of Bertrand Russell, famous philosopher. He said this: whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods, and what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. What science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. Maybe science is the only real basis we have for knowing anything. Maybe we're limited to this very partial, partially incoherent understanding of ourselves. Now, there's a problem with what Bertrand Russell says here. Bertrand Russell is clearly claiming to know something. And yet I know for a fact he did not discover this knowledge through scientific methods. He is a philosopher, not a scientist. He didn't go out and do an experiment. He sat back in his chair, smoked his pipe, and thought about it. So he's claiming to know something that, by his own definition, he cannot know. He's saying, in other words, we don't really need to pay what he's saying too much attention. So we're not going to. But what I do want us to do is think a bit more about the problem that underlies this, the mistake he's made. Here's another, long philosophical quote from another important philosopher of science. But he kind of, I think, puts his finger on the mistake. And I'll read it out and then explain a bit more about what it means. He says, if he be a man engaged in any important inquiry, he must have a method, and he will be under a strong and constant temptation to suppose to suppose that the universe ultimately is such a sort that his method must be appropriate and successful. What he's saying is this: that there's a constant temptation when you've got an idea of how to understand the world to assume that the world is exactly the way that would mean your method would work. It sounds a bit abstract, but it's a very, very basic mistake. In fact, it's a mistake I think that my daughter, here's my daughter here, had learnt not to make by the time she was about this age, which is about 1 year old. A couple of months before that picture was taken, I could be playing with my phone in front of her, like a typical 21st century father, and she'd want to reach out and play with my phone. At the age of 9 or 10 months, it was enough for me to simply put my phone away in my pocket, and she would happily forget about my phone, act as if it no longer existed, and move on to wanting something else she couldn't have. But a few months later, that no longer worked. She'd realized something very important about the world. Just because she couldn't see my phone didn't mean it wasn't available for her to play with. She just needed to use a different method to get access to my phone. She needed to tug on my sleeve or put on a cute face like that, and sooner or later she'd get access to the object of her fascination. That method has, by the way, stood the test of time. And scientists learn this very early on as well. We learn that it's no good saying, I've got this really great assay, it always gives me reliable results, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to limit my understanding of my subject area only to what I can find out through this particular assay. An astronomer doesn't say, well, my telescope can only see so far, so I'm going to squeeze my conception of the galaxies only into what I can see through my telescope. Now, scientists know that they need to go and find new ways of seeing further and deeper. It's a mistake to try and squeeze your subject area into what's allowed by your method, because it ends up distorting the way things really are. Now, scientists know that you need to let the way things are then go and shape your method. Scientists tend to ask a very important question. We call it the hypothetical question, the question, what if? We say, what if there is more out there to discover? What if it was like this? How would I get access to it? That question doesn't just motivate new research, it actually helps us decide how to do the research. We say, what if it is like this? What would it look like? How could we test for that possibility? That's what scientists do all the time. It's how we go beyond the current limits of science. So let's, as we finish, return to this topic of purpose that's cropped up a few times and ask, what if? What if there is more to life than simply survival and nervous systems than simply passing on our genes? What if love lay at the heart of what the purpose of life was about? What if the purpose of our brains actually was to discover what's true and real and make sense of the world? How would we go about discovering and exploring something such as purpose? Here's a theologian and philosopher called Leslie Newbegin, and he says something very helpful on this. He says that cause can be discovered by science, but purpose cannot, because until the purpose has been realized, it is hidden in the mind of the one whose purpose it is. Newbegin sees that although patterns of cause and effect can be uncovered and interrogated by science, there's something different about purpose. Because purpose arises out of persons. People who can look forward and see the future and form desires and make plans and take steps to achieve those desires and fulfill those plans. That's what purpose is. And as such, it's hidden. It's hidden in the mind of the one whose purpose it is. Newbegin gives an example, illustration of coming across a building site, or what seems to be a building site. You see some bricks stacked up here and there, some tools lying around, a trench in the ground, and you decide that there could be some kind of purpose to what you see. It's a bit like how we encounter life, isn't it? There's lots of mess and chaos and unfinished business, but there's all kinds of signs that life is meaningful, that our actions are significant, a sense of frustration at the way things aren't the way they should be. There's all kinds of signs of purpose in how we go about living in this world. But how are we to discover what this purpose is? Well, Newbegin says with the building site, you've got two options. You can kind of take the empirical approach and go back later and see for yourself what emerges out of the rubble, what form this building is going to take. You can wait, in other words, until the purpose is realized. Or, Newbegin says, if you don't want to wait, you go and go and talk to the architect, the builder, the one whose purpose it is, and ask them to reveal it to you. But Newbegin says when it comes to discovering the purpose of the universe, the purpose of our lives, then waiting around until the end isn't an option. We'll only discover the purpose if the one whose purpose it is makes it known to us. At the heart of Christianity is a very remarkable claim that God, the one whose purpose it is, has made not just his purposes but his very self known and knowable to us. This is how one of the accounts of Jesus' life starts. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. That word is the Greek term logos. It's this idea in Greek philosophy that behind everything there was this fundamental rationality that kind of made sense of the world. And the job of the Greek philosopher was to try and uncover this logos and then live their lives in harmony with it. It's where we get our word logic from, this inherent rationality. And John takes this word, and he does something very interesting. He personalizes it. He says, he was in the beginning with God. For John, this logos was not something, was not an abstract principle, it was someone. But then he goes even further, and he says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known. The Word became flesh. He's talking about the person of Jesus, God in human flesh. The reason, ultimately, for the success of science is, I think, not so much to do with the ingenuity of its methods, although they're often very ingenious, nor is it to do with its institutions and the rigors of its practices, or the commitment of scientists and all of that needs to be credited. Ultimately, science is successful because of the accessibility of its subject matter. Science deals with the stuff you can get your hands on, the stuff you can prod and poke and manipulate and control. When science advances, it's because new techniques have come along which allow us to grasp, to reach and get hold of new aspects of reality that were before beyond our grasp and reach. Science is successful because of the accessibility of its subject matter. The Christian claim is that we can know God, the one whose purpose it is, for exactly the same reason. Because in the person of Jesus, God has made himself accessible to us. He's put himself within our reach. What do I mean? Just 2 points as we finish. God in Jesus, by becoming flesh, by entering history, has first of all made himself accessible to our scrutiny. Christianity stands or falls on a historical claim. This is a claim you can investigate. You can't investigate a private revelation in a cave or a lofty philosophy or a mystical experience. These are things that have to be taken on faith. But Christianity ties itself to a particular historical figure. And says you can look into this person and investigate it for yourself. Like a cosmologist detecting cosmic radiation from the Big Bang right at the beginning of time. Or like a paleontologist investigating the impact of an asteroid millennia ago. So we can see the impact of Jesus on history, the impact of this crucified carpenter's son, this person who here we are today still talking about. And we can ask, how can that be? What was it about his life that gave his legacy? What happened in that moment? We can investigate these things and explore them for ourselves. And this is what the New Testament writers invite us to do. Says John in his letter, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. But God's accessibility to us isn't just about investigating a historical claim. Because John says that ultimate reality is not just something, but someone. And that means that this reality is accessible to you and me personally. Ultimate reality is not some abstract principle. It's not some deep logic or force or matter that is only accessible to the great minds of scientists and philosophers. John tells us that ultimate reality is someone and can be encountered through a relationship. Now, I'm a scientist. I know that might make you feel uncomfortable, like the Sheldon caricatures so wonderfully in the Big Bang series. Scientists are often more comfortable dissecting their subjects of investigation rather than talking to them. We don't tend to be people. But you see, if ultimate reality is not something that you can prod and poke and manipulate and control, but is rather someone who addresses us, then your approach has to change. I'm a scientist, but I'm also married, and so one of the things I've had to learn is that doing experiments on someone is not a good way of getting to know them. When I first met my wife, she said to me, "Hello, my name's Ney." If at that moment I said to her, "Look, I'm a scientist, I can't accept truth by revelation, please show me some form of identification, please." Knowing her now as I do, I'm pretty sure she wouldn't be my wife today. I'd never have actually got to know her. My method would have determined my reality. If ultimate reality is not something but someone, then our approach to that reality has to change. To write it off and insist on only believing in things you can do an experiment on is ultimately to decide the answer even before you've begun your investigation. It's an attempt to tell reality how it should be. It's not, in other words, good science. To explore this possibility means opening yourself up to the possibility that God is there and that he wants you to know him. Opening yourself up to this claim that he knows you and loves you and has gone to very great lengths to make himself knowable to you. How do you do that? How do you investigate that claim? Will you look at the New Testament documents, you explore them, see if their claims stand up to scrutiny? But also, I think it would be appropriate, given that this is not something but someone who addresses you, to experiment with prayer. If God's not there, then the null hypothesis will stand. Nothing will happen. But if he is there, then being honest with him, talking to him, asking him to reveal the truth to you, explaining your doubts, your hesitations, starting, in other words, to try and relate honestly with this relational reality, may well be the most scientific thing you could try and do.